So Bernard's going to come and bring our reading for today. Thank you, Bernard.
The reading is from Matthew chapter 5 and verses 33 to 42. You haven't got pew Bibles, so this is a great opportunity to get out your phones and all the other things you've got to exercise the use of these modern aids. And I should be reading from the NIV if you have a choice of version to follow. This is a section from the Sermon on the Mount, and in the version I looked, or the publication I looked at, is headed Oaths and about the eye for the eye business. So, Matthew 5, chapter starting at 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond that comes from the evil one. You heard it said, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. These are Jesus' words.
And in the light of Jesus' words, I would like to ask you to transfer all the funds in your bank account into my bank account, because I'm leaving, all right? I'm going away. Is that how it works? I think that's how it works. Some great teaching here in this passage, but I don't know about you, but how many times have you heard those words? I mean, lots. And don't every time you hear them, they just make you think, huh? Really? How is that even possible? Well, we're going to unpack this a little bit for ourselves today. I don't know if any of you have ever had the opportunity to listen to a preacher by the name of Tony Campolo. I mean, he's not so current these days. I mean, he's getting on a bit. You know, the young'uns probably haven't heard of him. But I've had the opportunity to hear Tony Campolo on a few occasions. He's an interesting chap. He's an American, but he spent most of his ministry working in black churches. And so he's used to lots of interaction and lots of shouting back and amens and encouragement. And oh, God, please help him if he's preaching bad one particular day. But I remember him, he's got lots of great stories, which I've often poached and stolen as my own over the years because they're so good. But there's one particular illustration that I heard him use in Southport, of all places. It was a large sort of conference, and we were there. He was preaching. He was talking about Elijah. And he was talking about the fact that Elijah found himself in a situation where he felt he was the only one of the Lord's prophets, and so he was feeling a little bit sorry for himself. But in that situation, there was a desire to really speak for the Lord. And Tony started to talk about, you know, those little weather vane things that you see in the top of buildings. You know, I don't think we have any weather vanes. We've got some interesting wrought iron fountain springy things on the top of our building, but no weather vanes. But on tall buildings, you see those things that turn around. They've usually got chickens or something on them. And what they do, of course, is that whenever the wind blows, it's weighted in such a way that it blows in a certain way, and you can tell what direction it's the wind is blowing in, because apparently that's useful. You know, I don't know. I guess in some situations it might be useful. But Tony was talking about the fact that in the world that we are in today, it's very easy to be blown around with all sorts of winds of opinions and situations that we found ourselves in. And actually, as Christians, we can end up being like those weather vanes on the top of buildings, blowing around wherever the wind happens to blow us and take us. And I remember this very clearly. He simply said, get a nail and stick it in it. Get a nail and stick it in it. In our lives from day to day, find that absolute solid foundation, which is, of course, Christ, his word and his teaching, and stick to it. Be grounded in it so that we're always pointing in the same direction. That image has just helped me to think about what it means to focus on Christ and his teachings. This teaching we're looking at in the Sermon on the Mount, as you will have noticed, is pretty challenging stuff. You'd have found that last week as we thought about some of the things that are in the passage before this, thinking about things like divorce and all those sorts of challenging things which are difficult to grasp. But this teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount is ultimately about being a distinctive, intentional community. There's something about belonging to Christ that should make us stand out and stand up and be distinctive. The things that Jesus was saying in this passage were dynamite. Even in a religious sense, I mean, a lot of the things that he's saying in this passage go beyond even the local religious sentiment, the local religious conventional wisdom. He's turning it on its head. In several parts of the Sermon on the Mount, you'll notice the pattern that arises. Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, such and such a thing. And then he says, but I say. You've heard that this was said, but I say. And that should cause us to prick up our ears and listen. It would certainly cause his immediate hearers to sit up and listen. Wow, what is this new teaching? We are going to pay attention to this. So we're going to dig into this passage, particularly about what Jesus is saying in this section. And it starts on this whole idea of oaths. I don't know, a few weeks ago we talked about promises, didn't we? We were coming to the end of our Joshua series, and we were talking about the fact that the people were invited to make an oath to serve the Lord and to serve him only. We thought about some of you who had made promises. Some of you could remember your guide promises, and some of you could even remember your marriage promises and all those sorts of things. But here we've got some really interesting teaching on the whole practice of making oaths. Now, oaths were something which actually had wide use in the Old Testament. You always had people making certain verbal promises and covenants with one another, just to sort of shore up business deals or marriages or any promise that they happened to make. God himself, in various places in the Old Testament, makes an oath between himself and the people. So oaths are a thing. And the people that Jesus would have been listening to would know that oaths were a thing. That's how they conducted day-to-day life. So what's the problem? What on earth is the problem? Well, the problem is maybe not so much with the concept of oaths themselves. But Jesus is saying, look, when you are living your life in the light of the Beatitudes, when you are living your life for me, when you're living according to the values of the kingdom of God, it transforms your integrity. You become a person of deep integrity because your encounter with Jesus as the truth, the way, the truth, and the life transforms your inner response, and you become one who is filled with integrity. Jesus is raising the bar on integrity again. There's something here about humility. There's something here about integrity of living. I should be able to hear a yes from you and know that it's a yes. I should be able to hear a no from you and understand that that no is coming from a good place. I have to say, this little sentence in the New Testament has been so precious to me because it's actually, weirdly enough, one of the verses that God used in the process of my conversion. I mean, let your yes be yes and your no be no. That opened my eyes to something that I had never encountered before. I gave a testimony a few weeks ago, and some of you might have been there. But I had got my little red Gideon's Bible from the Gideons, and I'd started to read it Matthew, because that's what's at the beginning, so you start to read there. And I got into this Sermon on the Mount, and as I came to that passage about let your yes be yes and your no be no, I thought that's fantastic. And the way it spoke to me, because I think there were so many things in my life, particularly at that time as a young person, where I felt that I was having to fit in with this and fit in with that, be one person to that group of friends, be that to another set of friends, be something else to my parents, and you start to feel that sort of sense of being torn all over the place. And then this little verse comes in, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And I thought to myself, I want to explore more of this person who said something so profound and something so straight that would enable me to be who I am. That's how I interpreted that verse. It really spoke to me. And ever since, there's been that sense of our yes and our no should be enough. We should be straightforward. It's maybe something of my Scottish nature as well. You know, I like to call a spade a shovel. You know, let's just say it as it is, folks. I mean, have you ever come across those situations where you get people and you have to sort of prance around because you're not quite sure if you're going to say the wrong thing in the wrong way, or if your tone of voice isn't just going to be right, or, you know, sometimes you have to do that to be nice. But there's just something in here about integrity. So make promises, but think about what you're doing. Your integrity should speak absolute volumes. Cultivate that ability to be sure, not in ourselves, not even in heaven, not even in earth as its footstool, not in Jerusalem, we can't make a, you know, for those of us that have got hairs on our head, we can't even turn them black or white or anything. We can't swear about anything, but we can let our yes be yes and our no be no. Some of you might need to hear that this morning. You're in situations in your lives, you're dealing with friends or family or work situations where you just feel that you have to be able to say, absolutely yes. Absolutely yes, I will do that, I am in that. But some of you will find yourselves in places where you just have to say no. And you don't have to justify your no. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I think that is a freeing thing. I think it is a freeing thing that Jesus offers us. So that's that one. But it gets challenging from there, doesn't it? Because then we've got the whole sort of, you know, doormat Christianity, you know. Just lie down and let everyone walk over you. Turn them all your cheeks and let them be slapped. You know, give away all your coats and all your shirts and, you know, sort of allow everything to be taken from you and be left with nothing. And always go the second mile so that you're absolutely run ragged and lying on the floor because you're such a servant-hearted person. I'm looking at some of you. I know you're out there. And it's very tempting to look at this passage on the face of it and actually think, I don't know how possible that is. Have you ever thought that? I don't know how possible that is. And throughout history, you see, people have looked not just at this passage, but the whole Sermon on the Mount and said, well, that's impossible, isn't it? So who shall we get to do this? I know who we'll get to do this. We'll get the monks and the nuns to do this because they are shut away from big, bad society. They don't have big, challenging decisions to make. We'll just see this section, Sermon of the Mount, that those that are shut away from the rest of the world, they can do that. That's fine. They've got more opportunity to practice that. But we who have to sort of do deals and live in the world and, you know, us governments who have to make decisions to go and, you know, thrust our sword in the sides of our enemies, we won't take anything to do with this. Do you know the first Roman emperor who converted to Christianity? Anyone know his name? Constantine, yeah. He was the one who sort of made a conversion. But do you know that he held off baptism until the very, 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 very last moment that he possibly could? Did you know that? He was baptized pretty much as he was lying on his deathbed. Why? Because he thought it would be impossible to live his life as the emperor and live out the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. He thought it was completely incompatible. And that is, sort of raises the level of challenge that not only do we find this stuff challenging, Emperor Constantine thought it was challenging, and people down through the ages have found it challenging. But who is Jesus talking to here? Is he talking to an elite religious group? Is he talking just to his holy disciples or not so holy disciples? Is he talking to the he's got a crowd there. He's preaching a sermon on a hill and there is a multitude gathered. He's saying, this is for you. Put this in your pipe and go and smoke it, chew it, think about it. It would provoke much thought and reflection. So let's unpack it, because this whole business is difficult. Now, the whole eye for an eye thing, you know it comes from the Old Testament, don't you? You know, this whole principle, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And that, in the law, was an early attempt to start to bring some civilizing influence into the early culture of Israel. They had to have some sort of base upon which they would run their communities. And so it was a simple practice of justice. You know, so if your well-being and your economic well-being is based on having two sheep, and then some silly idiot comes along and kills one of your sheep, that's going to leave you out of pocket. So the other person would have to compensate you for a sheep. And there's details of what the compensation was for a sheep. You know, it's very, very practical, very base information. And it's a step away from case. So this is good teaching. But then Jesus comes and he turns the whole thing on its head. He raises the bar of integrity yet again. Something about humility and gentle living. In verse 39, it says, do not resist an evil person. We have believed that this means that we have to give in, and so this whole teaching becomes impossible. But this whole language of resisting is actually about legal transactions, different to responding to day-to-day insults, violence, and abuse. So we turn, look at these things in turn. So let's begin with turn the other cheek. Anybody want a slap? Just come and line up here. And of course, I can't slap you because we're not touching each other. So you've got off. I was looking forward to that illustration. I was looking forward to having someone that we could come and, you know, it's good for the soul. It's good, you know, it's not. You didn't hear that. But this turn the other cheek thing. I think it's fair to say that other people have used this down the ages to submit to certain things that probably should never have been submitted to. Even in the life of the church, where there's been domestic violence, there's people who have stayed quiet because they submit to an abusive relationship. You know, this is real stuff, and it comes often from a misunderstanding of some of these passages. But let's explore it a little bit. Turn the other cheek is not about enduring physical violence. A backslap is an insult, but it was often used, not even in terms of its physical enactment, but it was used as an idiom to talk about an insult rather than an act of violence. So turning the other cheek is about being willing to take insult and insult in terms of how it appears in terms of verbal, but it really isn't about lying down to physical violence. The Beatitudes say that insults will come. Insults will come because of your faith and a whole load of other things, and so we must be prepared for them. But there's something about the physicality of this that we perhaps don't understand because we don't understand the context. So, a Roman soldier. Picture a Roman soldier in your mind. He's got his red cockade coming out of his hat, his arm, and he's got his Roman kilt on. He's got all this sort of thing. And he's got some slaves, and he's got some people who are working with him. Now, under regulation, a Roman soldier was permitted to take his hand and draw off the side of the face of his slaves to keep them in line, okay? He was allowed to take the back of his hand and slide it off the side of his face in order to keep his slave in line. Jesus comes along and says, turn the other cheek. Why would we do that? Well, the Roman soldier wasn't allowed to strike you twice. And he certainly wasn't allowed to strike you on the front of your face. So if he's struck you on the face one time and then you turn your face towards him, if he comes back the other way, he's going to hit you in the face, he's going to hit you twice.
And so there you've got an act of non-violent resistance. Turn the other cheek to those who slapped it. Now that's, have you heard that before? Have you come across that before? We read this passage under our years of conditioning. And actually, when we dig a little bit further, we can see there's more going on here. This was an act of non-violent resistance. To turn the front of your face towards your Roman oppressor and to invite them to smack you in the face would have caused repercussions for the Roman soldier. This is not doormat teaching. It's saying you're going to have persecutions that will come, you're going to have trials that will come, but you can respond in a way that is not eye for eye, tooth for tooth. You can resist and you can do it cleverly. You're going to go and read all your commentaries and you're hardly going to find this because we haven't thought about it. But think about it. I'm offering this to you this morning as a reflection as to how we can dig deeper into this. And then there's the whole issue of taking garments. You know, if you fancy somebody's coat, it's not just a little bit of a license to steal somebody's coat. Although I have to say, someone has stolen my alcohol hand gel from the pulpit. If it's you, may God give you a conscience and no rest until you bring it back. All right? All right? I'm talking to you. But the taking of garments. Jesus talks about if someone sues you for your shirt, well, you can have your shirt. If that happens, give him your coat as well. So the shirt, what's he talking about? The shirt is your undergarment. Your undergarment, okay? It's your boxers and your other bits, which we won't mention in polite company. You know what I'm talking about. It's your underclothes. It's the thing that you wore under your outer garment, and it would cover all your nakedness. So if somebody is coming along and they are suing you for your shirt, you are going to be naked because it's probably the only shirt you've got. You are going to be naked, and by the fact of you being naked, you might feel a little bit of shame, but actually, the person who has sued you for your shirt is going to feel a lot of shame because he or she has made you naked. How does that change what we've often thought about this passage? Let them take your shirt, Jesus says. An act of non-violent resistance. Let them take your shirt. Let the shame be upon them for their injustice. And then he goes on to say, let them take your coat as well. What's Jesus talking about? Well, in the Old Testament, in Exodus chapter 22, verses 26 to 27, the law forbids that anyone should take anyone's coat because they need it to stay safe, warm, and secure. It's against the law of God. So if you're allowing them to take your shirt and then you're insisting that they're taking your coat, what happens to the perpetrator? They become a lawbreaker. It's an act of non-violent resistance. I hope this is going for you this morning. This is revolutionary teaching. Jesus is nurturing a community that he knows is going to come into face-to-face with some significant challenges. There will be times when the culture tries to hem them in and bring them down, but there are ways to respond. There are ways to live with integrity and to respond to the challenges that come to us without resorting to the kind of behavior that they are resorting to. There are ways to resist. Are you possibly ready for one more? Are you possibly ready? Because then we start to talk about if someone asks you to go a mile, go with them 2 miles. Now, isn't that something that most of us want to sort of hold as our own? You know, I'm the kind of person who's always willing to go the second mile. Have you ever sort of thought that about yourself? You know, I'm kind, I'm loving, I'm caring, I'm compassionate, I'm helpful, and I'm a second mile kind of person. You know, most of us would probably think of ourselves as that. And that is a good thing. It's a good thing to think of ourselves as servants and helpers and carers of others, isn't it? No, yeah, it is. It's a good thing. But that is not the context of this passage. We have taken it out of context for such a long time. This whole business of going the extra mile, it is another act of non-violent resistance. Because you see, if you were living in the first century, a Roman soldier was allowed to apprehend anyone in the community, anyone passing by, and say to them, "For the course of 1 mile, I would like you to carry my pack." Remember, Roman soldiers were often marching to far-flung corners of the world. They would get tired. The army had to advance. And so they had this right as part of their authority to draw in the locals and say, "Carry my pack for 1 mile." But they weren't allowed to force people to carry their pack for a second mile. To do that, they would face a charge. They would be up on discipline. So they weren't allowed to force people to carry their packs a second mile. So if a Roman soldier was forcing you to take his pack a second mile, who becomes the offender? The Roman soldier becomes the offender. This is an act of non-violent resistance. It's not about we want to serve one another, but this is about drawing boundaries at what's acceptable. And Jesus is saying, if you find yourself in a situation where you're being pushed beyond what you can reasonably take, there's a way to take a stand. Let your yes be yes and your no for no. There is an integrity, there's a wholesomeness about belonging to Jesus. There's a wholesomeness about humankind. And this is how you might respond. Can you think of a situation in your life where someone isn't just happy to take the first mile, but takes the second and the third and the fourth, and it becomes difficult, and you think, I'm at the end of it. Have you ever got to that stage? I'm at the end of that. We can find a way to take back what rightfully belongs to us, to draw boundaries around our lives, especially when we find ourselves at threat, especially when we find ourselves in challenging situations. There is enough as enough. Now, this morning, you might want to choose to just go back and read those passages and think about them in the way you've always thought about them. That's fine. But I want to encourage you to think afresh, to look at them with fresh eyes, to peel off those layers of an inherited interpretation and think, what is this saying? Jesus is saying we are invited to live lives of integrity. Yes, we're invited to live generously. We're invited to live intentionally, but we're invited to stand in the dignity of our own person, to reject at every turn any abuse that comes towards us, to live wholesome and right lives, and to find ways to protect ourselves and protect others in the line and in the way that our life unfolds. But at the end of the day, challenge will come, suffering will come, hardship will come. But in Christ, we have the foundation to stand our ground. So that will give you plenty to talk about over dinner, plenty to talk about with your friends in the week, and it will give you plenty of grounds to string up the pastor for heresy. So I'll be available next Sunday in the Market Square. I'll come ready with just my shirt on, which you can take, and I'll give you my coat as well. I'll turn you all my cheeks and everything else that you want to do, but we'll be able to stand together in Christ. Jesus, revolutionary teaching. Let's take an opportunity to look at it once again. And there was nothing more revolutionary in the teaching of Jesus than when he gathered his disciples around the table and pointed to bread and pointed to wine and said, "This is participation in me." And to participate in me is entering into a brokenness. It's entering into a pouring out of yourselves. And so we, in a rather unusual fashion, are actually going to come around the Lord's table this morning. We're going to pray together. We're going to reflect on his death and resurrection. Reflect on our invitation to step into the life of Christ. So let's take an opportunity to pray together.